This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Good evening. Welcome to Teachers Talk Radio and tonight's Late Late Show, which will be hosted by me, Emily Edwards. This week, we'll be looking at how to answer some of the most frustrating questions you could hear in a history lesson and how to banish those ideas to Room 101.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Teachers Talk Radio. As I said, my name is Emily Edwards, and for any recurring listeners, welcome back. It's good to chat to you again. And if this is your first time with me, here's a little bit about my background in education. So I'm currently teaching secondary history as a full-time classroom teacher. I started my NQT year back when it was called an NQT year in 2017, and I have an NPQML as well as experiences in middle leadership, both in temporary positions as a pastoral deputy head of sixth form and curriculum lead for history, though thankfully not at the same time. I also have experience in teaching Key Stage 3 to 5 for history and Key Stage 5 A-level politics. So when I was thinking about my show tonight and what I wanted to discuss, I had a think about all the phrases that seem to be hardwired to wind up even the most hardened of history teachers. And I thought it'd be a really interesting show tonight to talk about those sorts of phrases, why they wind us up, getting to the root of why certain statements in a history classroom particularly can really have an impact on teachers, and how do we then start to challenge those ideas, sometimes playfully, sometimes seeing the opportunity that they can be to really delve deep into our subject. So when I did have a think about some of these phrases, I think we could all come up with a fair few off the top of my head. And in terms of looking at your responses on Twitter, had some great feedback about some of the phrases that you feel are really common within a history classroom that unfortunately are still common in a history classroom. So from the "did this really happen" moments to the tearing of hair when reading yet another "the source is not useful because it's biased" in a GCSE mock paper, I think we've all been there. But why do these seemingly innocent phrases really strike a nerve? And what can we do to challenge some very real concerns that are growing all the more important in our current kind of socio-economic and political climate, and how that reflects in our microcosm of the classroom? So in tonight's show, I'll be talking about the phrases that have plagued me personally during my career, as well as my go-to answers for some of them now. And I'll also be sharing some of your answers to my Twitter or X poll that address the same sort of question. If you do have any of your own that you'd love to share in the chat, please feel free to share the pain, and we'll tackle some of the ways to hopefully put those sorts of one-liners that we hear in a history classroom into Room 101.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
This week in the news, is World Book Day a burden on parents? Has the tide turned against hyper-discipline in schools? Is Scotland going to be excluding more students? Should we be talking up the benefits of going to school at a school that is turning the clock back on mobile phones? World Book Day on March 7th has become a fixture in the school calendar. where pupils are encouraged to come to school dressed as their favourite characters, or bring books to donate or tell their friends about. This celebration of reading, though, has become a little controversial, as reported in the BBC and The Guardian. Parents have complained of increasing pressure to buy commercialised costumes or spend time and money elaborately creating their own. Some of the pressure has a class element, with some parents sending their children to school dressed as characters from Harry Potter, while others might be the Artful Dodger. Head teacher Fran Davis from Michigan Primary School in Mountain Ash has said she wants the day to be fun without being a financial burden. Therefore, she suggests that pupils can come in their pajamas, suggesting their favourite bedtime book, or simply in school uniform, as they might be pupils at Hogwarts or even Greyfriars. If you wish to hear teachers' views on World Book Day, listen to last week's Late Show with Lucy Neuberger on Teachers Talk Radio. One of the most significant developments in education in the last few decades has been the trend towards positive discipline, or military-style discipline, in schools. And this provides the context for the next two stories this week. The first story appeared on the BBC and was covered by the Guardian newspaper. And it's about the Michaela School, led by the controversial head teacher, sometimes described as Britain's strictest head teacher, Catherine Birbal Singh, who has been in the news for the school's policy towards Muslim prayers. Half of the pupils of the school are Muslim students. Two students have given interviews where they describe a toxic atmosphere of the school and an atmosphere of fear and being stripped of their identity. If you wish to learn more of this story, you can find Tom Rogers' interview with Catherine Birbal Singh on this topic on Teachers Talk Radio. The increasing prevalence of tiger-style teaching, strict discipline methods, zero tolerance, and first-time-every-time expectations of students across British schools was highlighted when a parent at Boston Spa Academy complained her autistic son found school intolerable, as over a period of only a few days, he acquired 56 negative comments and several days in isolation. Boston Spa Academy schools have appeared frequently in Education Uncovered and other news outlets for their strict approach involving lining up for inspections and an expectation that rules will be obeyed instantly and at all times. Not for the first time, teachers' unions have described these policies as inhumane. This week, Scotland's Education Secretary, Jenny Gilruth, announced that there would be a review of Scottish Government's policy on exclusions. The number of exclusions from schools has dropped considerably in recent years, as a determined policy of avoiding school exclusion was adopted following research of a link between excluded students and later involvement in crime. However, with one-third of teachers in Scotland reporting in a survey of the EIS union that they had suffered assault or physical violence in the previous year, pressure to review the non-exclusion policy has resulted in a reconsideration. School attendance is once again in the news. A survey revealed that nearly a third, 32% of teachers and school leaders have experienced pupils being absent this academic year because of a parental dispute with the school. The survey by Teacher Tap asked 8,411 teachers and leaders in state schools in England in January what reasons they had been given for pupils missing school this academic year, other than illness. More than half, 51%, said pupils had been kept home because they were tired after an event the night before. Nearly 9 out of 10, 87%, said wanting to take a holiday during term time was the reason, while more than 3 in 4, 76%, pointed to family events. John Camp, president of the Association of School and College Leaders, warned in a speech to the union's annual conference that the unwritten social contract between families and schools is fracturing, and he called for a change of tone in the national conversation about education to ensure that people talk up schools and colleges. And finally, another story from the BBC, where Milldown Academy in Blandford Forum head teacher Mr. Law has adopted the policy of providing brick phones, old-fashioned simple mobile phones for students. Parents can hire or borrow them as an alternative to smartphones, which are increasingly distracting, in the school. You can find more discussion of these and other stories on Teachers Talk Radio or reviewed each Sunday on Teachers Talk Radio Panel, which you can find the links to on YouTube or the Teachers Talk Radio site. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio News with John Gibbs.
Right then, so it's going to be a little bit different tonight in terms of how I'm structuring the show and laying things out. Because normally, as I'm sure many recurring listeners will know, I like to go with a section looking at the problems and the origins of what we're talking about in the topic of the show, and then looking at solutions and how we can address whatever we're talking about within an actual classroom setting. However, I thought since if I'm talking about lots of different phrases and comments that we might hear in a history classroom, I thought the best thing to do would be to look at some of the big offenders individually and address why they wind us up so much before suggesting some of my thoughts on it and potential replies for each one. If you do have any better responses that have worked for you in the classroom, please do also share those in the comments. I'd love to hear different ideas, and I'll take any other tools to add to my belt going forward. So without any further ado, let's get into one that annoys me, I think, more than anything else in a history classroom. The age-old question and annoying phrase number one, Miss, did this really happen? Now, I'm going to be honest and say that the reason for me anyway as to why this gets under my skin more than any other phrase that I hear and that we'll talk about tonight is that at its best, it's a really innocently asked question, but suggests that I might be an idiot who's been talking nonsense to 30 plus kids for an hour. Or at worst, it's suggesting that I don't know what I'm talking about. It's a bit undermining. And that I might be just outright lying to students. Now, I know that 9 times out of 10, it's perfectly innocent, and usually it's accompanied by a topic that's quite shocking or something that is difficult to believe. Sometimes reality is stranger than fiction. But I think obviously as a professional, it's sometimes hard to separate that personal, immediate kind of reptile brain response and the actual reality of that situation. And I know that for me, I know like many of the members listening in, I take obviously my job very seriously and take a lot of pride in learning more about the world and being as knowledgeable as possible for students so that they get the best education possible. And also in terms of history, I know how dangerous misconceptions can be about various topics. So I would hate for students to walk out of my lesson with a misconception or worse, with just an outright lie that I've either willingly or accidentally spread to them. So this idea that did this really happen as a phrase is just something that gets under my skin and is something that I think even innocently asked does hit me a bit harder than I'd like to probably admit. And I think I worry that I don't know enough for students. And I know this isn't something that's ever been a reality. It's part of somewhat of an imposter syndrome. But it is something that I've worked incredibly hard to build up my knowledge, like many teachers across different subjects. I know we're focusing on history tonight, but I know there'll be teachers in every single field that are worrying about their subject knowledge and wanting to keep building and building to try and reach this level of perfection. But it is something that still worries me. So to hear that either I don't know what I'm talking about or that I've been a bit lazy and not bothered with the correct information, or I've just kind of gone on a flight of fancy and told a really fun story that I thought the kids might be interested in, this is something that I think is at the root of why this phrase annoys me and annoys so many of the history teachers that I've talked to about this. Now, when I think about this without my reptile brain and with the professional, sensible, rational part of my brain, I think it very quickly comes to mind that 9 times out of 10, as I said, it's asked completely innocently out of this genuine desire to know more about what they are doing in the lesson and the topic they're studying. And especially with topics like the Holocaust or warfare units or about life before many of the modern technologies that students are accustomed to, I think at its very core, it is something that's going to be quite common in history classrooms. It's not going to be unusual that students struggle to take on board the heaviness of the content or the abnormality of the content compared to their context. But I do think it's actually fascinating when I've actually questioned back to the students why they've asked that question, to kind of back up where this is coming from. And whilst this next bit is completely anecdotal, so I am sorry that there isn't any scientific research to back this up, but having spoken to students over the years in my classroom, I think it's led me to discover a really clear source, from students anyway, where this comes from. And I think a lot of it has to do with the internet. And this is going to be a problem, I think, more unique for my generation, obviously, being more savvy or having that mixture of being born and growing up with my childhood without the internet, and then hitting the teenage years and Facebook being the massive social media platform. But obviously for young people today, that is their everyday life. That is what they have grown up with, what they know. And obviously compared that to teachers far more experienced than me, who may obviously not grown up with the internet until their adult lives, and having those three different experiences and worldviews has led to this conflicting idea of being able to take on board particularly shocking information. And now I do hasten to add that this is a bit more than just the big bad internet rant. But I think it comes down to this idea of the internet, because firstly, with the accessibility of the internet, anybody can claim to be an expert in any field. I think we've all seen it on social media. You read something that you have experience in and someone has completely gotten the wrong end of the stick based on their lack of experience, but they're talking about it as if they have the expertise that you have. And I think social media alone allows ordinary people to share their views and, you know, hopefully mostly facts with a wider audience than academics could comfortably before the turn of the century. And there are two aspects to this. I think this is, on a positive note, absolutely fantastic for young people, because they can now engage far more with perspectives and factual sources from, say, those same academics who might have had their research contained originally in academic journals or papers only seen by those who went to university. They can now have that access at a much younger age and engage with history and a lot more wider history as well, rather than just the books they can find or the sources they can find within classrooms or within people they're aware of, their social circle. And I do think, though, that this is a bit of a double-edged sword. So yes, we have people being able to spread accurate information far wider than they ever could before the internet, but then that obviously means people can share misinformation too. And in particular, I've noticed a rise in conspiracy theories garnering incredible amounts of attention and support, and the rise of the internet linking to a lack of media literacy means that young people in particular can access, absorb, and even spread misinformation far quicker and easier than maybe generations ago. And in particular, I've seen conspiracy theories being adopted by students about the moon landing being fake and having to deal with that in a classroom on the Cold War and the space race, having students talk about anti-Semitic things they've seen online, as we've talked about the history of anti-Semitism, and realizing they're starting to link that actually this information isn't accurate and is something that they shouldn't be absorbing. And ultimately, I think seeing this genuine interest connecting with students is sometimes leading them down dangerous rabbit holes that then we have to address in the classroom when they turn up to the lesson and go, yeah, but miss, did this really happen? And absolutely, Tom, it is a problem sometimes with educators saying that, I mean, some head teachers believe the moon landing was faked. That is a terrifying comment to read, but I know it's absolutely the case. I had my one of my mentors at a previous school share a tweet, well, I say tweet, it was on WhatsApp, it was a message about how Black Friday was linked to slavery and that I should be teaching that in my lessons. And it was incredibly uncomfortable to have to say, actually, no, that isn't the case. This is a popular meme that was spread a couple of years ago and had gained a lot of traction. And I think if it's something that adults can fall into, I mean, it's perfectly understandable why students would be asking those same questions. And I think it also hurts, in essence, for us as educators, when students sometimes don't go down the idea of accepting new knowledge and instead, because of all this misinformation, close themselves off and become just downright skeptical about everything, which again is a reason where this question comes from and why it can be a bit frustrating, because we know we're trying to do best by our pupils and sometimes it feels they just don't trust us. So how do I respond to this question? Firstly, I stop and not take it personally. That's always a good start with any statement that winds you up. But I think I see it now, especially after questioning students about where they are coming from. I see it as a great learning opportunity. And the reason I say that is because when I talk to students about how we know about events in history, where we get the information from, and how historians are like detectives in piecing things together. And that is something that we are doing in the lessons, as well as historians are doing in the academic field and in the academic world. It's a wonderful way to show the importance of history and my subject to students. And also as well to give them a sense of ownership of the history. We are putting the evidence together and you are creating your answers and your judgments. Yes, it is an exam question, essay, for example, but it is something where you are making your judgment. You are engaging with the history just like any historian would. And it can also be very useful in terms of emphasizing the importance of studying history, the idea of how do we know what the right decision going forward is if we don't know what mistakes were made in the past, and proving that some decisions, some choices actually do not benefit us as individuals or as a society based on how they've worked or not worked in the case in the past. So I think by reframing the annoying phrase or question into a great opportunity serves two main purposes. First, if it's a genuine curiosity, then I think it's being rewarded with a genuine and full answer. And students love authenticity. And we are giving them a better understanding about how they can learn more about the past. And it builds up trust, not just with the content of us giving accurate information, but they trust me that if they ask me a question and they ask it seriously, I will take it seriously and I'll give them a clear answer. I'm not going to dismiss it and thereby dismissing them. They feel they have a security in the classroom, that they'll never be laughed at by me, no question is a stupid question, and that I'm authentic in wanting to help them learn, because I'll answer even questions that may not feel directly linked, but actually provide a great opportunity to emphasize the importance of history. And the second purpose is that if a student is taking the mickey, and this is our kind of 1 in 10 scenario, the sincerity with responding to their attempt when they try and get a rise out of you is something that will de-incentivize them or disincentivize them to try the same method twice, because they're not going to get under your skin. But also, when I've answered an attempt to wind me up with genuine sincerity, I actually managed to win over the students, and it came very quickly to me that this student was just trying to test me, test my knowledge. I was a relatively new teacher, so for him, he was just seeing where I stood, whether he had a chance really to undermine me. And ultimately, how this went about was that he asked a couple of questions, he flicked through the textbook, picked a person, said, "Who's that? What do they do?" I would reply back, "Oh, that's, you know, that's Frederick Douglass. He did speeches about abolitionism and wanting to end slavery, as his experience as a slave." And he'd start with, "Well, but is that real though? Did he really do that?" And talking about some of his speeches that I'd read and finding these opportunities, I think after about two solid answers, A, he kind of gave up, and B, he genuinely started then throughout the rest of the lesson to ask me genuine questions about the topic we were actually studying. And based on that building of trust and that genuine authenticity to what was essentially an attempt to take the mickey, I think he saw a light bulb moment, because when he asked me eventually, I think after about the fourth or fifth question, "Miss, how do you know all this?" I told him that it's the same way that he learns it. The idea that I'm going through the information, I'm asking questions, I'm not just settling on a basic answer. I'm building on it and seeing where it leads me and trying to piece the full picture together. And it was something that I worked at. It's not some divine gift or luck or natural intelligence. It's purely through graft. And from that point, I think he realized it was something that he could do as well. It wasn't something that just because I was a history teacher, I had this encyclopedic knowledge of history the second I walk into the classroom. It's something that I've worked at and that he could work at as well. And I think ultimately it was a massive success and it was this turning point. And I'm not going to pretend that it was all kind of smooth sailing from that. He did have his moments throughout the year. But after that lesson, and it was the first time he did so that year, he said thank you to me on the way out. And it was one of those moments where I think as a teacher, we all have them, where you just feel like you've made a difference and you've had a really purposeful moment. And I'll be honest, after that, we had a chat with his parents at parents' evening, and they were really quite glowing about how curious he'd been about history. He was talking about history for the first time at home with them and sharing what he'd been learning in lessons. And I look back and think, what a terrible missed opportunity that would have been to have such an incredible connecting moment that has made a difference in my working relationship with this student. If I hadn't actually taken the time to take that annoying phrase and twist it into a really good opportunity. And absolutely, Paul, yes, it is one of those wins that you think make your week, make your month. In my case, I think it pretty much made my year. But it is something that, as professionals, we are taught to deal with that kind of reptile brain and don't go into kind of fight or flight and just act as a professional and take things professionally. But I think with all experiences, it's always when you look back and you take the time to understand how the thought processes behind their questions can lead us to make much better, much more valuable answers for both them and for us as well as educators. And frankly, as a history teacher, who doesn't love a chance to show off a bit of history and why we love our subjects so much? And I think that can be something that can apply to any subject, any specialism, both at primary or at secondary. This idea of showing students that the knowledge we have isn't some sort of preordained gift only reserved for the talented. It is for anybody who has the curiosity to keep asking questions and wanting to see that bigger picture. So that leads me then to my next annoying phrase. But miss, why are there just so many dates we have to remember? And I know for history teachers in particular, this is a phrase that annoys us because it suggests that we're the only hard subject on the curriculum and that history is just dates, names, kings and queens, that old chestnut. And absolutely, as Paul's saying, the teacher's love for the subject they teach comes across to pupils and can make that spark happen. And without it, there are many less wins. Absolutely. This idea that if we just focus to these stereotypes, to the basics of what we do, you know, walking in, teach the lesson, walk out, without taking that genuine excitement and enthusiasm that we have, these annoying phrases are just going to get under our skin and we are just going to keep making opportunities kind of disappear for us rather than being able to take that and really help to build on our, not just our professionalism, but also our ability to connect with young people. Thanks, Paul. Please keep the messages coming in. So I've already talked a bit about how history is more than just a timeline of events and that history is about the stories of people and this amazing collection of experiences, both ordinary and extraordinary. And I really enjoy sharing that with students. But the second an exam crops up, either at Key Stage 3 or at Key Stage 4 or Key Stage 5, I get students absolutely panicking with, well, we need to know dates and why are there so many of them? And I just keep getting the dates mixed up. I can't remember them, miss. I don't know what to do. Can you help me? All that jazz. And sometimes it feels like no matter how many times I do a subtle kind of spot check via kind of retrieval practice questions or hinge questions, where I see students share these fears, but then confidently share key dates. I just sometimes ask for years and they give me days and months and years. And it's the sort of thing that can frustrate me when I think that why are they insecure about their knowledge? They're clearly incredibly knowledgeable and they've worked so hard for this. Why can't they see it? And maybe it's just the pressure of an exam, but when students, and particularly those with SEN who may be struggling with cognition on top of trying to remember dates, or dyslexia, especially when we have issues with numbers, getting numbers mixed up, obviously that can be a huge fear that they're going to make a mistake, and this idea that there are just too many dates to remember really just suggests that history seems to be this pub quiz of facts rather than this very rich, deep subject of experiences. But I think as well, a frustrating element isn't just being frustrated that I can't support students and get them to see their own successes, but also that history isn't the only subject that can be challenging, and relegating history to it's just a really tough subject kind of undermines the hard work that I think a lot of subjects put in, and how that actually there are lots of different topics or subjects that are genuinely difficult. I'll put my hands up and say physics or languages can comfortably take that title for me based on my experience at school. But all those topics, whilst they were hard, became a lot easier when you gave them a genuine go. So whilst I struggled with physics and I had to do French, and so my French, I'll be honest with you, is not fluent, unfortunately. It is something that when I had to do the GCSEs, I worked incredibly hard. I knew it was one of my weaker subjects. And I know, shock horror, when I put the effort in, I succeeded. I did well. I worked hard and I saw that effort pay off. And I know this is going to be quite a mind-blowing show in terms of teaching grandma to suck eggs, I think. This idea that effort is required in school. And yes, things can be hard, but with resilience and with a mindset of trying and succeeding, that obviously only comes with effort. And so how do we challenge this in classrooms without undermining students who do feel insecure, and make it not an attempt to brush off their fears, but an actual attempt to boost their confidence? And I think my favorite thing to do is to kind of lean into the support and take the pressure off. So my initial go-to phrase is, well, it's better to be accurate and a little bit vague than it is to be specifically wrong. And I found that students who struggle with remembering dates are more willing to give it an attempt if they feel they can get away with blagging it a little bit. So if I say to students, well, if you can't remember, germ theory, for example, is in 1861, it was published by Louis Pasteur, no worries. If you can remember Pasteur as a surname, or if you can remember that it was in the early 1860s, yes, that's a bit more vague, and in particular with the date, it wouldn't be as excellent as the exact year, but it's better to be correct and to say, yes, it was, you know, the early 1860s, rather than it was 1863 and being specifically wrong. And normally that gives them that little boost of confidence and a feel of a safety net, that they'll get a bit of mercy from the examiner if they can't get the exact month or the exact year, but they'll still keep picking up marks for not being, you know, historically wrong. And especially when it comes to GCSE and A-level, I know we've got lots of different subjects, and I think we're all in the same boat of lots of content, not enough time. And so a great way to help support exam classes in that sense is to help them remember that relevant and accurate information is more than just simple dates. So for history, key phrases, names of programs, individuals, etc., all of them are relevant and accurate information, and they can be used along with, or sometimes they're better piece of evidence than specific dates. And I think when you tell students about different individuals, personalities in particular are great for students' memories. They might not be able to tell you all the specific German terms for, say, Hitler's foreign policy, but they'll tell you, you know, by the back of your hand, everything they know about Hitler and his personality and his aims and how he persuaded people through charismatic speeches that played on Germans' fears and manipulated people into supporting horrific ideas. And those sorts of stories, which don't necessarily sound very evidence heavy, actually provides lots of knowledge that students can demonstrate without that fear of the specific number date. And if you're 1 year out, that's it, your GCSEs, damn the pam. And I think then it's easier for students to start adding in dates when they can start feeling confident with the general story, the general narrative. So overall, I think boosting confidence is the main way to overcome students' fears with dates. And obviously, hopefully then we can see the phrase of, oh, why are there so many dates in history becoming more endangered as a phrase in the classroom. And before we jump into our next annoying phrase, we've just got a couple of key messages.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
And welcome back. So, jumping in then to our third annoying phrase, what do I absolutely not want to hear in a teaching environment in history? Can I still get the mark if it's not the exact date? Now, this one, thankfully, is a phrase, whilst very annoying, has a very quick response. No. But you'd be surprised how many times I've been asked when we've done, especially Key Stage 3, Year 7 or Year 8 students, ask me as we're marking tests or when they've got their feedback, can I get the mark? It's only a year or two out. And it is the sort of thing that does wind me up slightly, because if I could get away with just not being accurate, my life would be significantly easier as a history teacher. But as we've talked about, I'd be incredibly unprofessional. So obviously for students, we aim to have the most accurate and up-to-date information possible. And because this one is an annoying phrase that I don't think we'll ever fully get rid of, but I've noticed that whenever I do hear this question and they hear the answer no, we see what I kind of call the five stages in terms of responses. So firstly, there's that denial. What do you mean, no? Then will come a bit of anger, light frustration. Well, that's stupid. It's not even that far off. Then usually a sense of bargaining. So what if it's only 1 or 2 years out? Can I have the mark then? I only put the 8 and the 6 the wrong way around. Can I swap them back and get the mark? Which I know obviously feels really ridiculous. And my quick response, if they do try to bargain, well, if everybody forgets your birthday, would you be accepting that people got an important date for you completely wrong by only a few days or months? Or would you expect people to remember those key dates because they're important? And usually, to be fair, they grumble and accept it and just say, oh, right, put the cross by their answer and then move on. But there are a couple that might have gone into the fourth stage of, I say, depression, but obviously very, very mild of, well, I'm rubbish at history. I can never remember dates. And after a bit of boosting, they'll usually finally accept that, okay, right, I got the date wrong. I'll try again next time. And usually that will be a bit of a rinse and repeat. I did have one student who genuinely went through kind of all those stages throughout the lesson, not all in one go, thankfully. And to be honest, I found that this phrase, and bless that response, which I appreciate the dedication to wanting to get 100%, but bigger picture needed to be referenced a couple of times there. But in terms of why this one doesn't bother me as much as some of the other phrases, I think partially there is a sense of cheekiness that I find endearing, and this is a personal trait, this idea of wheeling and dealing for an extra mark, and it's particularly on the low-level quizzes or tests that we do. It's rarely ever mock exams or end-of-year exams. It's usually on those quick quizzes where you think, of all the things to try and wheel and deal and try and get away with, this may not be the best use of that time or that talent. But you never know. That's that endearness to that cheeky attitude may disappear after the first decade of teaching. But for right now, I think having a cheerful, you know, nope, try again next time, works for me and keeps the mood light. Students don't feel particularly chastised. it's a relatively low level disruption in that sense. I don't really see it as significant to address on any bigger scale, and doesn't really provide many opportunities for us in the classroom, but it is a little bit of fun. If you do have a better response to can I still get the mark if it's not the exact date, please do let me know in the chat, because I do find some extra tools always are welcome on my tool belt. So that then leads me to my last kind of big annoying phrase that I want to put into room 101 before I talk about my Twitter poll. And that is the age old, the source is not useful because it is biased. Now, I'm saving the big one here until the end. And this is probably the bane of most history teachers' marking. And I'll talk about obviously the Twitter poll and how they responded to this phrase. But from a departmental standpoint and from my own personal experience, I think I will always find at least one exam response on a GCSE source paper that will have this dud phrase at some point. So why does it bother us as a profession so much? First things first, from a history teacher perspective, it's lazy and it's wrong. It's lazy in the sense that students don't feel they need to spend the time or energy justifying their viewpoint, as they have this buzzword of bias, and spellings may vary on bias or biased, and they feel that's self-explanatory. They think that, obviously. We know for examiners and teachers that it's the equivalent of a shrug, and shows that a student doesn't actually understand the source, or maybe isn't willing to take the time and the effort to really delve deeper with that source analysis. For it being wrong, and this one is more so for any of the teacher outside of history listening tonight, it's just not true that a biased source is automatically something to be discounted. So it's not even a valid statement to make. For example, if I wanted to know why Britain supported the empire, and I read a source from someone who was British during the time of the empire's peak, promoting all the propaganda points about the empire, then that would be the perfect source for me to answer that specific question. And I try and explain this to students that bias doesn't mean inaccurate or useless. It might be that it is one-sided, as the nature of bias is, or that there may be two sides to the story, or that they're coming at it from one specific viewpoint, and by ignoring all the other perspectives, it doesn't give you the full picture. But it doesn't mean it's useless. And in terms of these sorts of questions in exams, particularly around the idea of usefulness of sources, seeing that phrase, the source is not useful because it is biased, does kind of make my heart sink when I read it on a paper in particular. And so this idea that we have to really work at our explanations for students, so I never just kind of give it across and ignore it. My favorite thing to do is always to use that as an example in exam feedback to break down what's the problem with that phrase, why can bias source sometimes be useful, and ultimately what is it useful for? How could I as a historian take something that is very clearly one-sided and use that to my advantage to understand a wider topic in a bit more depth? So say back to the empire example I just used. If I wanted to know views about the British Empire, or if I wanted to know about different methods of propaganda that the British used to promote the empire at its peak, or the idea of were there actually any positives about the empire, especially obviously for Britain, we gained a lot out of the empire. And I think all of those different perspectives and those different outcomes from that single biased source all provide valuable information, and particularly in an exam question, easy way to pick up lots of marks by not just taking that easy road out and going, right, what is the quickest, shortest way I can wrap up this answer and hopefully pick up a mark or two. Now, usually in terms of fixing this, as I've said, exam feedback is a great way to directly address this and talk about it. I've also found that modelling source analysis with students, both after the exam, but also before the exam or throughout lessons, has been a great way to see clear improvement. I know throughout kind of educational Twitter, there's been lots of great resources about the importance of modelling and how we can use that for our explanations to better show students what success looks like so they can then mimic it themselves. And in particular, when it comes to sources, I found that having a checklist, and this can obviously vary depending on what you use in your schools. If you have various acronyms that work best, please obviously feel free to use those. If you do have any good source analysis acronyms, please again, feel free to pop those in the chat. Always happy to do a bit of magpieing as I'm doing the show. But my checklist is, in essence, a series of steps. So step one, what can I literally see in the picture or text? So usually if it's as a visual source, what things can I see in the picture? What is somebody wearing? What do they look like? What are they carrying? If there are any details about the background, what can I see? If it's written source, then obviously what is literally being said? Not reading in between the lines at this point, just going with the face value. And this is something that obviously all students can do because in theory they've got eyes that work, and if they're giving it a go, they should be able to find key features that they can visually see or read. Then step two, what can I figure out about the topic in the question based on what I've just seen? So I like to have a checklist that builds on the previous steps just so that it is very clear for students to see the order of processes, and they see them progress pretty immediately. They're building on it. They're not just keeping lots of ideas in their head simultaneously. It's a growing and developing process. So usually kind of where does it come from will follow after that. So once I've read in between the lines, what does it tell me? So with the empire, does it tell me that British people gained a lot from the empire, or that propaganda was used to persuade Britons about the value of the empire? Then the best thing to do next is, where does this source come from? The nature, origin, purpose, classic NOP. So once obviously I figured out where it is, again, same process, can I learn anything by reading in between the lines about where it comes from? So I know for students in particular, I have drilled into them that if it's usually a political cartoon and they see the word punch anywhere in the provenance, that is going to be your key as a satirical political cartoon publication. Hugely useful for looking at them taking the mickey out of something. So that kind of step-by-step process I've found through my own observations, through my own kind of feedback with students, that having that checklist and modeling why we can't just rely on the source is not useful because it is biased helps them to better develop their own answers. So they're not just going for the easy answers in their mind. They don't need to. They've got a clear step-by-step that builds on very basics to more developed answers. And it naturally forces them to then explain why a source is useful, because ultimately it tells them so much. And the wonderful thing about a lot of sources that we have in terms of primary sources in particular, they are invaluable within history to learn more about topics. And so there's always going to be a source that gives them something. So with that being said, moving on a bit from my experiences to start moving towards obviously your responses. Thank you in advance for everybody who participated in the Twitter or X poll. Great to obviously see different people's perspectives and hear their opinions. And in particular, looking at the options, I did say, what is the most frustrating thing to hear in a history lesson? Did this really happen? It's not useful because it's biased. It's only 2, 3, 5 years out, and there are too many dates. Now, when having a look at these responses, I was actually quite surprised. So the answer that received the most votes with 36% was that there are too many dates being the most frustrating thing to hear in a history classroom. And I think I was slightly surprised more so because I had my own personal take on this. As I said, I have students who seem to be a bit more skeptical than apparently other people's classes, because I usually hear, did this really happen, more so than anything else. And as I've talked about, why that gets so deep under my skin is very personal to me. So this idea that more teachers are frustrated by students' exasperations over the amount of dates they have to remember, I think is really quite interesting. Although, to be fair, the poll itself was quite close. So we had in second spots with 32%, so just under a third, it was the source statement that it's not useful because it's biased. I think that's coming mostly from history teachers who have GCSE and A-level classes. Reading those, I can well imagine if you've been marking classes of, say, like 15 A-level students or 30 year 11 students in a single class, I can well imagine seeing any of those statements can be incredibly frustrating. The third option, third highest, so did this really happen? As I've talked about, that's my bugbear, but it is good to know that nearly a quarter of people, just over a fifth of people, agreed with me that this is something incredibly frustrating. It's nice to be validated with this show every now and again. And then that leaves with only 11%. It's only 2 or 5 years out, that idea of do I need the exact date in my answer? And again, I come from a very biased perspective, talking about the idea that I quite like the wheelie dealer mentality and that kind of cheekiness that you only get from, I think, young people trying to chance it with trying to get an extra mark. But again, I can well imagine if you have 5 or 10 students trying to debate their marks and debate the grading that you've given them, I suppose that could be a little bit more frustrating depending on the situation. So with that being said, I think it is, as always, absolutely fascinating to hear different people's responses. And I do love, obviously, people being able to get involved for these Twitter polls. So I will keep obviously doing these going forward because I love hearing all your feedback. And absolutely, yeah, Paul, it's something that's even happening in primary by the sounds of it. So he said, in primary, we're plagued with the half-assed attitude and wanting recognition for minimal effort. And absolutely, I think there is a sense of apathy at the moment. And I think we could have a whole nother show talking about the reasoning behind that, whether that's COVID related, whether that's just another generation, or whether this is something that maybe we didn't recognize it as much when we were in school, because we were the high achievers, we were the hard workers, we were the ones who really benefited and enjoyed school as young people. But absolutely, it is, I think, frustrating, depending more so on the attitude of the students, maybe less so than what they're actually saying. I know I've had a couple of students try and use the, yeah, but did this really happen, to try and tempt me to go on a bit of a monologue. Not successful yet, but normally the, oh, absolutely, stay back at break time and I will tell you all about it, usually quashes any kind of mick-taking when it comes to that attitude and that apathy. But I completely understand where you're coming from. And absolutely, this idea of future shows addressing maybe that attitude issue and whether we can address that within the classrooms, whether that's a bigger societal issue, that is an amazing topic for a future show. Probably not good to try and address it now with only a few minutes left on the clock. But thanks, Paul. Love to have your comments. And I'll keep an eye out, maybe add that to a list for a future show title. Absolutely. And so ultimately then, based on what we've talked about, I do like to leave the show with a few kind of key takeaways that you can actually apply, obviously, in your own context, in your own classrooms. So I think ultimately a lot of annoyance is rooted in misconceptions. So we find certain phrases really annoying because they either perpetuate common misconceptions or have this belief that history is only about dates or biased sources. And that can be really frustrating for practitioners. My second takeaway, the idea that we can use these opportunities to challenge stereotypes, and this idea that emphasizing the richness and complexity of history beyond just the basic dates can really highlight a very human narrative to history, and showcasing the fact that it's about real stories, real people and experiences that help us both understand the past, but also can help us shape our futures and our future decisions. And also, as my kind of third takeaway, is that we can really empower students by addressing these phrases with sincerity and with a genuine desire to help them gain the tools they need to navigate learning and understanding more about the world around them. And this can be in terms of critically analyzing sources, not just taking things at face value, developing a more healthy skepticism rather than a very closed off view to any new information. And this idea that they can make these connections between events and concepts and build that confidence with the subject as a whole, rather than having a very closed off mindset that if I can't remember a date, then I'm no good at the subject as a whole. Also as well, I think as teachers, as one of my other takeaways for tonight, this idea that we can really emphasize the importance of efforts and accuracy over just kind of rote memorization. So this idea of building in the wider stories, taking the pressure off for understanding a laundry list of timelines and dates, and focusing more so on the wider story to then add in the variety of different types of accurate information they could use to show off their understanding and knowledge can really help to make the subject feel more meaningful. And again, to boost that confidence with students, especially those who are SEN and might feel uncomfortable at obviously putting in that initial effort, thinking they might fail, building up their confidence to know that anybody can succeed in history with the right mindset and by being genuinely curious. And then my final kind of takeaway for tonight, and this is one that I think is more as a reminder for me than for any of my listeners out there, but hopefully we're all somewhat in the same boat. I think it's really important for us to reframe these annoyances as opportunities. And it's important for us to do so because for a student to acknowledge either a misconception or addressing a question in a very authentic and sincere way gives us a really great opportunity to foster a deeper understanding and appreciation for history within our students and with our classes. And overall, I think we have such a powerful opportunity and ability in our classrooms to promote this deeper understanding and deeper thought of the subject, whilst also building in the skills and knowledge that they're going to need to help with their later exams or even just with their understanding of the wider world later on. So thank you to all my listeners again for tuning in this week. I really do appreciate people commenting and sharing their views either via the chat or via the Twitter polls. Obviously, if you weren't able to listen to this live, it's also going to be available on Podbean and the Teachers Talk Radio website for you to listen to later. And I do appreciate you guys indulging me talking about what winds me up in the classroom. And thank you so much, Paul, for that comment. I do appreciate it. And again, I'll say it before and I'll say it again, I'm always blown away by the fantastic responses. And it will be something that I'll keep up with the polls to help get people a chance to get invested and enjoy the show, both within the live time and also outside of it. And as a little bit of housekeeping, I'm going to be on holiday in the first week of Easter, trying to unwind after hearing all these statements for the past 5 weeks of the half term. So I will see you in a month's time, at least for my next show. Please keep an eye out on social medias for more details. And in the meantime, take care, and I will see you soon. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.